alongside of the pond, he is DJ Schweitzer. I am Jeremy Lance. Day blurg of quarantine. I don't know what number. I don't know what numbers are anymore.
I think we're, what, 2 or 3 months in at this point?
It feels like it.
It could be 2 or 3 years now. I'm not really sure.
Sure. It's a length of time that has not been enjoyable.
I know that I'm now cutting the grass, so that's how I'm kind of like gauging how far I think we're actually into this. But I can't remember if we've had like a whole summer, spring, and fall and everything that comes in between now and then already, because this is, it's all just, it's running together.
Yeah, I have not started mowing yet, but
lucky.
That's Monday. I'm trying to do some kind of more big picture stuff as far as like the lawn rehabbing it. So, yeah, I've been outside a lot doing like other like work on like the house and just kind of like just little, you know, kind of busy work things just to be outside and just to be doing literally anything.
Everyone's trying to fend off the cabin fever right now after weeks of being locked inside. I think we've been getting out doing walks, bike rides, setting up a soccer field in my backyard, I think, is going to be the next big task.
There you go.
And actually going out there and just ripping shots at the baby. That's what I'm looking forward to more than anything.
Got to start him young.
If you're going to cry, I'm going to give you a reason to cry. It's with my
Do you have kind of preconceived positional goals for your children as far as what you position you'd like them to try to excel in or what?
Oh, I mean, you know, if you're being a proper dad, I think you want them to play the same position as you. Yeah, okay. That'd be a goal since I clearly was not one of those. So, yeah, I'd love for any of my kids to be a left back. Of course, I'd love for any of them to be left footed as well, which is the gift that keeps on giving as far as any really sports related thing. If you are left handed, left footed, it's built-in advantage. But really,
baseball people find a spot for you if you're a lefty.
Yeah, I mean, for real. The amount of people that were mad that I quit baseball when I did was a little overblown, given that I'm just left-handed and can bat left-handed. So it is what it is. But if my kids like soccer, like, period, and don't hate it, like, I feel like I've already won a little bit there. That's the low bar I'm really setting for expectations of my kids with the sport.
Yeah, you know, with four kids, ship's kind of sailed on one of them to like anything sports-related. The girls are into sports. Grace is a bit of a wild card. Not sure which way she'll lean, but so far, I mean, I got half in the pro sports category, the pro soccer category. So I'm set.
All right, that's good. So your bar is not high at all, is what I'm hearing.
No, just half my kids tolerate soccer. I'm in a good spot.
Yeah, I think that's all you really need to set for yourself, especially in times like these. We find ourselves, this is our fourth quarantine special. I don't even know what we're supposed to talk about at this point. We're actually running out of news at this
There's
point.
Not much. There's not much news. Yeah, like we knew that the Olympics were punted to next summer.
Mm-hmm.
And then the obvious things have happened with that of like, hey, that roster you built that's supposed to be 23 and under, we'll obviously make an exception for those guys that are 23 currently on the roster that will be 24 next year. They can still play they can still be on the roster.
Yeah. So that U24 age range is obviously a boost for a lot of players who want to use that as a springboard for their careers. The clubs, of course, will hate that. That meaning older players being more exposed to the Olympics will always leave them a little not pleased about things. I think the other thing that we really are going to see a lot more of is the fixture congestion that this is going to pile up for, because with the 2022 World Cup coming not long after this Olympic cycle, qualifying is going to overlap heavily for both of those most likely. So how is that going to cut into player pools and how they were going to use players for developmental purposes and the Olympic qualifying and then get them in the World Cup qualifying? It's going to be a really interesting situation. And the age going up really only complicates this from the club's perspectives. especially as they try to figure out how the hell they're going to all cram in the rest of their current seasons, if that's something they're even planning on doing at this point.
Yeah, so I mean, next year you'll have the Olympics in, I would assume July is the normal spot for that. And then that wraps, and then you're talking basically 15 months later, the World Cup starts.
And it's a much longer qualifying process for the World Cup in most situations. So, yeah, it's a really, really interesting situation as things continue to develop there. Everyone's currently scrambling, just trying to figure out how they're going to finish the current seasons. Like places like Switzerland, they've just said, you know what, we're not even going to do this. Like, they've completely canceled this current season and just kind of said null and void. We'll figure out how to go forward from here. But everyone else is still in this limbo land, and at least we're getting some certainty with the international tournaments, but it's only going to make things more complicated as things become more clear with everything else.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like the Premier League is targeting a June plan. Not sure what that looks like. It sounds like there's going to be hopeful tweaks and exemptions so that players can finish out, running out of contracts in July. Those players can still continue on. Hopefully, that's what they're going to try to do. But there is kind of, it does appear that there needs to be sort of a hard deadline as far as like, if we can't get things going by so-and-so date, we're moving on. We can't, you know, we got to kind of just turn the page.
Yeah. And unfortunately, nobody wants to be the boogeyman that places that date on the calendar. And everyone's just kind of holding their breath, hoping this thing peaks and that we're able to get to a situation where we can restart games. I think every league, for the most part, is looking at this option of, can we centralize the games, minimize the number of, you know, employees and workers that you need to actually get that type of situation going? And the question is, like, when will it be safe enough to assemble that even limited number of people to make that happen? The NBA has been talking about doing that. They've been talking about doing that with the NHL. MLS, I've heard whispers that that's something that they're interested in doing. But, you know, for leagues like MLS or USL, it's a lot more difficult given how reliant the teams are on that ticket revenue to actually stay viable. So I think the wealth of leagues will determine when and what type of options they actually pursue. And we're far from getting any sort of answers in that particular realm.
Right. And you know, I mean, there is a July date of some sort I know that exists, at least for the Premier League, which basically, you know, if they don't have things done or going or whatever by that point, they lose out on a significant chunk of that TV money in that contract.
Yeah.
So I guess at least in that case, like for the Premier League, like that's essentially their hard deadline is like, this is the point where like all the money goes out the window from our TV deal. So let's get something done before that.
Yeah. And if that actually unfolds, that is when the metaphorical poo will be hitting the metaphorical fan in tremendous fashion as that cascades down the wealth pyramids into all the other realms of European soccer. So some of the other things we're kind of seeing is this coronavirus wreaks havoc on the soccer setup is all these clubs who are now reaching the point where they're having to do something about all the people they pay. And obviously the players are a part of that equation, and many teams are seeing their players voluntarily. It's not the teams ever requiring them to do this, but say Barcelona, they're seeing these huge wage cuts that the players have agreed to so that the staff, that make the club tick, the day in, day out workers in your front office and your support staff, so that they're able to continue receiving paychecks, which is a very generous thing of them to do. But then you're seeing, especially in England, and in particular, a couple clubs, one of which I support, that have taken a position of like, nah, we're just going to furlough workers and reduce wages for non-playing staff, which they can get away with because those people aren't on the same type of contracts that players would be on. And it's just, it's been really disappointing to see clubs like Spurs, you know, who I obviously support.
Who saw Daniel Levy doing that? That's shocking.
Well, and I tweeted about that. It's like, when he nickels and dimes some club for a gem that he unearths, we all laud him and praise him for his shrewd business acumen. But now in these scant times with low revenues coming in, we're seeing that same type of shrewdness and we all want to like pile on him. And I think it's deserved, right? But it is that dichotomy of, you know, him looking like a good businessman during the season when things are actually happening doesn't seem so malicious, but then you get in these type of situations when real lives are impacted and
right.
It's disappointing to see. And you'd really expect them, you know, for a guy who reportedly received 7 million pounds in payment last year, it's kind of hard to see him, you know, furloughing people and cutting the wages of people who are earning, you know, 50 grand.
Mike Ashley being the other real surprising character to be doing such a thing like this and furloughing people and you know, just kind of putting people in some tough situations when it's clear that the money's there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know the argument can always be made about wealthy owners and wealthy companies that, you know, yes, the money is technically there in like on paper, but as far as like what's actually liquid and what they can actually do as far as just paying people is a little different, but still, like, it's a bad look. It's happening there, it's happening here. I don't know, did you see what Minnesota United did?
Oh man, this was terrible.
They send out this email to like this. Basically, it's like they're part-time. And generally, when you're talking part-time with a sports team, you're talking about basically game day people. So yep. People that just work generally around like essentially event staff. So they run concessions, they rip tickets, parking lot, you know, the janitorial staff of the stadium. Just all the employees you see when you go to a match. That's essentially who we're talking about. Basically an email saying, hey, go collect unemployment. Or if you're interested, we hear these people are hiring. And it was like, hey, Pepsi and Cub Food, they're looking to hire.
Yeah. Like, why don't you go work at Target, our sponsor?
Yeah.
You know, they're trying to ship some packages. Yeah, not a good look at all. And, you know, really, I think Wayne Rooney came out and kind of dropped a hammer and saying, you know, a lot of players are receiving all of this, you know, kind of unfair pressure to donate their salaries. And I think that a lot of them are willing to do this.
Right.
But what he's basically getting at is like, listen, like, you know, we're just following our contracts here at this point. You know, we're willing to set up, you know, funds to receive the money as long as we know where things are going to actually end up and that they'll benefit people. But at the same time, I think that the pressure should be going on all these billionaire owners who, you know, they can afford to take a couple million dollar hit and it really just be a blink in their bank account and is not really going to have the long-term impact on them in these type of situations as well, even if it means selling off assets to be able to do that. you know, those are the things that maybe people with extreme wealth might be able to shoulder some of the burden here. But it's disappointing. Certainly something you don't want to see. Something else you don't want to see. Oh, yeah. Bribery. Not that we didn't all know it was there with FIFA, but it again rears its head in U.S. court documents.
Yeah, just out of nowhere, you know, you figured in some cases, you know, some courts were kind of like not really, you know, prosecutors were not really doing much work and, you know, things were kind of on pause right now like they are in most industries, but not for the prosecutors working the FIFA bribery case in the U.S. as new charges have come down to not only some of the people that we kind of already figured were involved, but like two former Fox executives, Fox being the recipient of the 2018 and 2022 World Cup TV rights fees, or TV rights in the U.S. Those are obviously the two Olympics in or two World Cups in question as far as this bribery goes. So, I mean, you can kind of draw some pretty easy conclusions about that.
I mean, remember, too, that Fox were automatically given the 2026 World Cup rights as well as basically, well, we know that you bid for the Qatar World Cup and that it was going to be in the summer. But because we can't do that this summer and we're moving it to the winter, we'll compensate you by giving you 2026 as well. So I'm sure there's some sort of underhandedness that probably unfolded with just doing a handshake agreement on literally $1 billion TV deal and just handing it no bid right over to one group. So that's probably something to be worried about. The other thing that was really interesting in these court documents was literal black and white wording that explains that there was bribery for people to actually vote for the Qatar and Russian World Cups. Not that, again, we didn't all suspect that and we didn't have ample evidence for it, but it's the first time that a actual government has come out and said, like, yeah, there's some bribery involved with actually getting these World Cups to the locations they were settled upon.
Yeah. So, I mean, we'll see what comes of that. I don't know. It was kind of one of those stories that gave up is the right word, but had moved on from and just figured, well, that comes to nothing once again, like always.
Yeah.
We'll see what these new indictments lead to and where this story continues as we roll forward to the 2022 World Cup.
Yeah.
In December.
Assuming we're even playing soccer at that point, you know, who knows if we're still under quarantine. What is that 18, 19, 20 months from now, whenever that actually is at this point?
Way to go real glass half empty there.
Well, you know, let's make it really empty. If you're trying to pass the time and not feel depressed about everything, you've probably already finished Sunderland Till I Die. I know you finish it pretty quickly. I know I did.
Immediately. I think I watched there's six episodes. I watched the first five the day it came out. And then, like, literally, like, forced myself to wait a day to watch the other one.
So you gave yourself a lot.
Yeah, just so I didn't kill. We got to ration the little entertainment we have. It's going to be a while. We got to thin it out. We got to have some here for, you know, in a couple of weeks. What are we going to have? And so that was kind of all these shows that come out, Tiger King and whatnot. Like I want to, in my mind, I'm going, hey, let's savor this. Let's parse this out as far as we can go with it. So we can really just kind of get as much entertainment out of it as possible and really stretch this out. And in all of those cases, I crushed it in a like 24-hour time.
I'll tell you what it is. As someone who's not a regular Netflix subscriber and has only recently dug into it, it's the autoplay. The quick...
Oh, yeah.
The quick, like, 20-second autoplay turnover that every Netflix show has is what drags you in, because before you even had time to contemplate the decision of am I going to continue on with this, you're already in the next episode. And you're like, well, yep. You know, I'm not going to lift my finger to turn this off. So let's just keep it going.
So, I mean, what are your thoughts? Sunderland Till I Die, Season 2, Wander's very own, Luke 09, being the kind of the young up-and-coming kid trying to make it on the squad, and I was really excited about that storyline. And then I just, you know, it's weird because it's like we already know what happened, right? Like it was the previous season, we already know what happened, we know they're still in League One, we know that didn't work out, and you might know even more specifics as far as how, you know, they get all the way towards the end to possibly get promoted and it doesn't happen. But that still takes away, like, none of the intrigue.
There's just enough of the little details that you don't get to see from the outside looking in, where you get to kind of see the little things that are bubbling along the way. The entire basically staff being let go, right as they kind of look like they're finding their stride out on the pitch in the beginning portions of the season. And, you know, not to, you know, give away too much, but there's a bunch of internal strife that's happening within the club as they try to find themselves in a better position out on the playing field. And I mean, as someone who's worked in the front office from a professional club, this is the underbelly of what you don't see when you're a fan right. on the outside. And there's a lot of tumultuousness that comes with professional sports due to the things that happen on the field, but there's a lot of it that has absolutely nothing to do with it. And Sunderland Till I Die is just one of those situations where you get to see that very rare insight of a club that has a lot of means, but really doesn't necessarily have a lot of knowledge about what they're doing.
Well, I mean, and how about that? Like, the whole first season ends with this new ownership coming in play. And already in this first season of this new ownership, they're like, hey, we don't have enough money to like take it where it needs to go. Like, we have to get more investors or sell or something. And this is the guy that just bought the club.
You're like, wait, didn't you know this going in?
You bought this 7 months ago.
It is amazing stuff, though. I truly enjoy the show. Even as someone who's not a big fan, I had someone tweet at me today and be like, hey, I'm a Newcastle fan. Could I even get into this? Or would I just be laughing at them the whole time? And like, you might very well be laughing, but you'll better understand why it might not be something you want to laugh about, because it could end up being your club pretty quickly too. So it's just an incredible unveiling. Again, as someone who's worked in the pro sports underbelly realm, it's a perfect encapsulation of what it can look like on both the inside and the outside.
So very good series. Check it out if you haven't already. What else have you been watching, doing, not doing?
We've been doing quite a bit of stuff with Added Time Outfitters.
Really, the US line or the MLS line?
Yeah, we launched 5 new bracelets this week. And, you know, we've had a really good response from them. Moved a whole bunch of them this week, which is really cool to see them going out to new corners of the country, and a couple foreign orders as well, which is always exciting too. So good stuff there. It's been keeping me busy on that front. But otherwise, just, you know, trying to teach the kids, trying to allow my wife, who's a teacher, space so that she can actually teach her students who are not in our home. Yeah, it's been a really weird kind of sense where everyone's getting cabin fever and they're all trying to get out into their yards and do the work and mm-hmm. do you can, because I think we're all just sick of sitting in the same space forever and ever.
Yeah. I mean, luckily it's starting to get nice here, in the Midwest. So going outside and hanging out and, you know, kicking the ball around in the backyard is at least a viable option. Where when this whole thing first kind of started, it was gloomy, rainy days of early spring, late winter. So yeah, that's nice. I watched a really terrible movie today. I was that bored. I watched a French movie. Right away, that's a bad thing. Yep. Why did I do that?
Yeah, not a good
there was no. It was not dubbed over. I had to read subtitles.
Ooh.
The whole 100 minutes of this movie that was, I think the best way to describe this, it was the French version of the Mighty Ducks.
Ooh.
I mean, it was definitely had all of the hallmarks of like 90s Disney sports movie. Like, think of all of like Mighty Ducks series, Rookie of the Year, Angels in the Outfield, like all that just goofy nonsense that we ate up like psychos when we were kids in the 90s.
Yeah.
Like, we got Disney Plus now, and I saw that like most of those are on there, and I got super excited about it.
So that's when you saw this French movie come across.
Move over the big green. I got a better soccer movie I'm about ready to watch. It was called Le Dream Team. It was basically, again, French Mighty Ducks. So like the Gordon Bombay character.
Oh man, please tell me it was Eric Cantona.
No, it was an aging striker for PSG who was being, and this is the actual plot point, was being phased out for Antoine Griezmann. And then he had like this whole like viral moment where he like his car was getting towed and he just started like cussing out the guy towing his car. And then this guy's like, you know, filming it with his phone and put it online. And so the I guess the French Football Federation or Lyon or someone came in and suspended him for 6 months.
Oh, that jerk.
So he had, what did he do? Is his agent convinced him to go back to his hometown, which is in like the Berry region of France. Yeah, I don't really know. I didn't do too much research on what that means, but it was kind of like in the country a bit, like okay. Not, he was not in Paris. He was in the country. And so he went home and his dad, played by Gerard Depardieu, was kind of the Hans role of like the old coach that kind of gives him like the advice and kind of sets him straight and convinces him to take this coaching gig. And so he takes this youth coaching gig of these ragtag kids that are terrible at soccer. And within like 2 weeks, he has them like qualifying for this tournament. And then they just go on a run and win the whole thing. Spoiler alert. And then also like Mighty Ducks, he spends a lot of the movie trying to bang the mom of the best player.
Oh, man. I mean, so, it's a perfect Disney storyline arc.
Exactly. I mean, that's Rookie of the Year that was the same way. You know, the teammate all of a sudden started like, hey, I want to date your mom. Like, that's always involved. The mom of either of the player, of the best player.
Yeah.
Someone's swooping in on her. Someone, she's just alone. She's a widow. Or, you know, dad just boned out on everybody and just hosed everybody. And thirsty coach and or player just comes swooping in. And at no point does the kid go like, hey, are you trying to bang my mom? Like, that dialogue should definitely exist and then yet doesn't.
Well, I'm sad now because I don't even need to watch this movie since you basically explained it to me.
It was fun. It was terrible. It actually got horrible reviews. Wow. And again, it was a movie that looked like it was straight out of the 90s as far as just like the hokiness and like the super predictable like 90s Disney sports plotline. But it came out in like 2016. There's also a slight Air Bud vibe to it because there's this golden retriever that hangs around the whole time. So, I mean, it was it was something.
Did the golden retriever talk?
No, the golden retriever, the best thing that the golden retriever did, again, spoiler alert, was die right before the final match.
Oh my God.
The dog dropped dead.
All right. Well, let's before we drop dead from discussing this ridiculous film, let's get into this week's top 10. We focus in on players for the first 3 weeks of this week. We're going to focus in a little bit differently and hit some grounds that we have on our bucket list that we want to actually go visit and take in a match. I'm presuming taking a match and not just go to the stadium and stand there and, you know, be like, oh, I've visited my sports, but actually go there and catch a game. We didn't put any restrictions on this, so we're not
saying any stadium.
It can literally be anywhere in the world. So,
I mean, we didn't put any restrictions on. I didn't play this way, but like theoretically, you could put on like a stadium that doesn't even exist anymore.
Yeah,
you'd be like, hey, I want to get in a time machine and go see the Highbury or, you know, some other dump.
And they were all mostly dumps.
Some other dump from a bygone era. I did not put any of mine in a particular order. I don't know if you did. That's fine. Go for it. I just didn't feel like... I mean, obviously, my number one is too obvious, right? Like, I want to go see a match at Stamford Bridge, right? Like, so that's like just too predictably easy of a number one. So like, because of that, like, I just felt there was no reason to kind of seed it out that way.
Okay, fine. I can see the fairness in that. This won't surprise you, but I also have the new Tottenham Hotspur Stadium pretty high up on my list. I was lucky enough to go to White Hart Lane, and, you know, it was a bit of a dump, but it was also quite the experience and something I'll never forget.
Our buddy Kyle at Rheinhaus, I remember his brother, who's a Spurs fan, did like a tour of Europe and went through England, and he was all excited. It was summer, so like there was no matches to watch, but like he wanted to go to the stadium, and he was baffled at the fact that the like gift shop was literally just like a trailer in an alley next to the stadium.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't exactly a trailer, but it definitely looks like it would be like in a hollowed out old UDF. For those of you who are from Cincinnati, you know, like, it's a UDF that doesn't sell gas. So it's kind of shady looking. Like, you don't know that you should be ordering any of the ice cream behind the counter. It had that vibe. So when you went in there to buy something, it felt a little skeezy, like you're cutting a deal.
Nice.
So, but yeah, I had them at number two on my list. Let's go to your randomly placed list on your top 10. You've only got 9 of them left though at this point.
So just kind of going from just crazy atmosphere, the Turk Telecom Stadium, that's Galatasaray Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, unreal atmosphere. It's one of those stadiums where you're typically going to get an atmosphere where it looks like good portions of the stadium are on fire because of the amount of flares and everything that's going off.
Yeah.
It's kind of scary and intimidating to do that, I would say, to go to that. Seems like a fairly hostile environment, but man, that'd be something to check out. Like that'd be quite the story to tell.
Well, too, like the Dutch, or not the Dutch, the Turkish fans are kind of nuts. They like are known for like digging tunnels to try to break into stadiums that they were banned from being allowed into, and you just never know what you're going to have. Like, there may be a ton of pyro, and then the stadium might legitimately catch on fire.
I remember there was that a couple of years ago. There was that Galatasaray, Beşiktaş. You know, the two Istanbul rivals. There was a match abandoned at one point because the fans were too unruly. And the fans at one point, I don't even know where they were in the stadium that they got these, but like, white plastic patio chairs were just being chucked onto the field.
Oh my god.
Like, Adam, did you bring that yourself? Was there like a little like beer garden that you just jacked those from in the stadium? Like, what how did you get those?
Any of the above is entirely possible. I also had one that, you know, if we're going on atmosphere, has certainly played host some great atmospheres, but is definitely a dump. And I had them really low on my list. In fact, number 10 on the list, and I think some people find this a bit sacrilegious, but the Maracanã in Brazil,
you know, okay,
hosted a couple World Cup finals. Obviously, I'd want to go there and actually catch a game there. Most of the games you see there, like, the place is damn near empty because they're really not filling stadiums up for club soccer in Brazil all that often anymore. But two, like, everything.
That is technically like the national team's home, though, right?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like you'd almost be obliged to go catch a national team match there if you could.
Right.
But like, the place just is kind of like dumpy. And I know it's historic and it's, you know, been this iconic location in the sport forever, but you have to have it on your list just because you have to. But I feel like it's probably the worst stadium on my list.
Okay. A stadium that also has probably seen better days, although I do believe there's been some renovation that's happened throughout the years on it. Again, going back to like a hostile, crazy environment, the Aztec. I mean, that'd be a pretty wild place to go see a match. I don't even know if it would have to be like a U.S., you know, USA Mexico match, or even just a Mexican national team against whoever. I mean, even just a Club America match would be pretty sweet to see there.
Yeah. I had them on my list as well. You know, but actually a bit further up, I had the Aztec at number 5 on my list. And I feel like I'll say this about more than a few stadiums on my list too, is like, there's a certain set of games you would want to go there for. And I feel like a USA Mexico match there, as long as I was disguised as a non American fan, most likely, just to save myself any potential strife. But yeah, I would definitely love to catch a match at the Azteca.
Yeah, love it. What else you got?
Number 9 on my list, the Bank of California Stadium, I think would be a really cool one. Home of LAFC. Yeah. Everyone that I've spoken to that's been to a match there so far raves about the atmosphere and just really talks about it being incredibly unique for MLS. And, you know, the MLS has desperately wanted this Latino market hammered down for a long time. And like they hit a home run with LAFC in the way they branded themselves and the way they branched out into the Latino community there. And I really feel like it's so unique in MLS because it's tapped into that type of atmosphere that's a lot more prevalent at Liga MX games as opposed to what you would typically see with a tailgating MLS type of atmosphere.
Yeah, no, I actually also have that on my list. And yeah, I think you kind of, the two things about it is the appeal of like the awesome atmosphere because of the, you know, that Hispanic influence that they got within their supporter base. And then also it's just like, I mean, from all appearances, it is the state-of-the-art MLS stadium at the moment.
As far as
I mean, they did it first class.
I mean, supposedly there's a pool in there, right? We'd be able to watch a game from the pool in very LA fashion.
That'd be pretty sweet. Can I keep my shirt on when I'm in there?
It's up to you.
All right, cool.
As long as it's not white, right?
Sure. Yeah, we don't need to do that. I had Wembley on, obviously. I think that's kind of just one of those like, duh, like that's probably on everybody's list just because it's so famous. And you just think about just the insanely big moments within club and country that has happened in that stadium.
Yeah, I mean, Spurs had a really good run there while they were playing away from home while they were waiting for their new home to be finished. Obviously, I got a lot of sentimental value there. I wrestled with the idea of putting Wembley on my list and ultimately decided not to do it. And I put her kind of on there for that same reason. But I really feel like the old Wembley is gone and the new Wembley doesn't necessarily kind of give you that kind of same feel. Maybe I'm wrong about it and I'm just not English enough to understand, you know, why the new Wembley still checks all those boxes. But I just felt weird about it because it's not the old Wembley, that I wasn't necessarily getting all the historicness of it that it normally would tow along.
It does. It is one of those ones that's like, because it's basically just the national team stadium slash a, you know, finals, a cup venue. The atmosphere, I guess, you know, can kind of come and go at a stadium like that, right? Like, it depends on the match and who's in it as far as if it's going to be a electrifying atmosphere or not.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of electric atmospheres, my number 8 is Celtic Park over into Scotland. This is one that I feel like you would have to go for the Old Firm Derby. You know, again, you almost need to like make sure you go as a Celtic fan or make sure you're going as a neutral and very clearly advertising as such. But I would love to see like just the back and forth between those two fan bases and to really kind of see the vitriol that actually exists between them in a way that I don't really feel like you have in many other places in world football anymore. Like, you don't see opposing fan bases in the same town that just hate each other in the same kind of way that you still kind of see with the Old Firm Derby. And Celtic Park really seems like the place you'd want to go to do that.
I agree and disagree. I totally want to see this, but I actually put the other venue. I put the Ibrox on there. Rangers home. But yeah, I mean, Old Firm Derby is one of those just soccer events that like would be kind of a bucket list event to be a part of and to see.
Yeah.
And to feel.
Yeah. To be honest, I'd take either one of them. Like, you know.
Yeah.
Next on my list, I went like the complete opposite direction here, and I felt like I needed to get a traditional English venue on, you know, the checklist. And I ended up going with Craven Cottage, Fulham's now expanded home. But it's like tucked in a neighborhood right along the River Thames. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's got the old, literally a cottage in one corner of the pitch. It has that old school vibe and appeal. And I wouldn't even need to see him play a big team. Like, I almost prefer them to play someone small, so you could get an extra dose of that kind of like original football club kind of feel that I feel like Craven Cottage would still give you while still giving you proper soccer too.
And you can go to that Brian McBride bar.
That's right. Legend.
So the old, well, actually not even very that old, but just kind of like traditional English one that I put on there. Again, no surprise, I had to go with Adams Park, home of Wycombe Wanderers. Small little 10,000-seater on the – I would not say exactly the countryside or a physical, like, countryside is literally where the stadium's at. High Wycombe is kind of like the outskirts suburbs of, like, the London area. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, kind of, yeah, just a different vibe, obviously, of going to a lower league side, not in a big city. It would be really cool. And obviously, one of a team I support would make it all that better.
No, I would certainly accompany you along for that trip.
Plus, I'd imagine the food is cheaper, so I could just really just go at it. Just really get at it, you know, eyes and everything.
Several pies, maybe even pass one to a player on the pitch.
Oh, and you know those pies are made from like they're made by like the same people that have been making them for like, you know, 40 years there, and it's someone's just grandma that's been making those pies for everybody and selling them out of like a little cart.
That Walmart hamster.
I really just want food not from my house at the moment, just because I just haven't gone this long without eating out somewhere. So
yeah, something that someone else has made, anything.
Just fantasize about that a lot lately.
I want a cheesesteak. I'm going to go to not a place where you can get a cheesesteak, but the highest ranked American park that I have on my list. And it's Portland's Providence Park. I think if there's a mecca for American soccer right now, Providence Park over in Portland provides the preeminent, what I'm going to call American atmosphere, quote unquote, whatever you want to kind of class that as.
Sure.
Some seem to think that's very apish of us kind of mocking or trying to put our own spin on the English game. But I love the way that Portland does their support there. They have an energy in that stadium, feels very organic. It doesn't feel kind of as coded as some of the other larger venues, you know, like Seattle or Atlanta, where it has, I don't want to say a plasticky feel, because I feel like that's an unfair way of putting it, but it doesn't necessarily have that same kind of vibe. And I really feel like Providence Park conveys that, and I've got to get this one checked off my list.
Yeah, that's a good one. As far as the other domestic ones that I picked, I have to go with, whatever it's going to be called, Skyline Chili Park, Tide, Arena. Park. I don't know what we're calling this thing.
I hope it's,
but, FC Cincinnati Stadium, Graders, Thunderdome, whatever it is, obviously it'll be pretty unreal to go to for that first time. Yeah, soccer-specific stadium in our city. You know, just kind of this landmark that we've been able to watch be built and get to kind of be, you know, we'll be. It's a stadium we're actually going to be able to go to the first ever match for, be there from the beginning. we talk about all these historical stadiums that we've kind of been listed off. This is a chance to go to one day one.
Yeah, no, I'm equally excited for that. I didn't include this one simply because it's not built yet. But I feel the exact same way about the new downtown Crew Stadium. I was lucky enough to be at the first games, both in Columbus at Ohio Stadium, as well as for the brand new Crew Stadium when it was first built before it was abruptly changed to Monterey Stadium a few years back. But I'm looking forward to being at the debuts for both of those stadiums, even though neither one of them is on my list.
I think the one stadium that so many put down because, again, going back to just crazy atmosphere, would be the Signal Iduna Park, Borussia Dortmund's home stadium.
Yeah.
I think, honestly, if you really dive in, there is something really awesome about the atmosphere within really across the board in the Bundesliga. I think Dortmund is kind of the one that shines the most and we see the most and is the most iconic as far as the yellow wall and all that stuff. But I think, honestly, you could replace that with like any packed out Bundesliga stadium would be unreal to go to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, watching games, I've taken an interest in Schalke this year and just kind of watching their games and the atmosphere that they bring match after match is just so much more energized than I feel like what you see in the English game and certainly within the American game in a lot of respects. It's just such a stadium-wide type of environment that you see. And I had the Westfalen Stadium for Dortmund on my short list as well. Going and see that yellow wall would definitely be, a bucket list type moment. But yeah, I agree with you. You could swap in a Dortmund. You could, swap Dortmund out for a Schalke or Bayer Leverkusen or a Munich or whatever it might be, and you'd certainly get just as good of an experience. Another one that I had that I think a lot of people end up throwing on their list. And this one, the atmosphere is good, but I think it's more the scenery that it's placed within. And it's the Pedreira, Estadio Municipal de Braga, Braga's home stadium in Portugal, where it's literally, I said the Pedreira at the beginning, that means the quarry. And it's literally built into an old quarry. And there's a huge stone facade at one end of the stadium that just – is so, I don't know if you've ever been to like Red Rocks in Colorado, the famous amphitheater where they do a lot of live shows.
Yeah.
It just makes you feel kind of more connected with nature. And I feel like this stadium would kind of give you that whole, like you're part of something bigger than yourself type of atmosphere. And every picture I've ever seen of it has been breathtaking. For that reason, I definitely want to get that one on my list.
Yeah, no, I this was the one that just missed my list, actually, because you're right. It's that iconic picture that we all see of that stadium with on one end behind the goal, just that kind of that, kind of mountainside right there, just right up against it.
Yeah.
Back to crazy atmosphere and insane atmosphere. And I don't know why I pick all these stadiums with crazy atmospheres. I don't like being around people. I don't think I would actually enjoy any of this, but there's something romantic about all of it. Would be La Bombonera.
Yeah.
Which is, I believe you use this as a picture for when we posted this on Twitter. This is Boca Juniors stadium, a unique setup for the stadium where you have three sides of the stadium is kind of your traditional setup. And then one whole side of the stadium just goes straight up, and it's all these, I don't know if it's like boxes or terraces and stuff like that, kind of just a mixture of those. Yeah, it's just kind of like this one tower that goes along one entire side of the pitch.
Yeah, I mean, it almost looks like a stadium has been cut in half, and then they just like drop like this really skinny, awkward tower up. Yeah, it is mostly boxes. But the way that the stadium's kind of shaped makes the acoustics there really, really cool. This is another one where, like, I've had friends that have been lucky enough to go there and catch a game, and they're kind of like, you can't adequately describe it until you go and experience it, because it's not just something where you're going in and catching a game, but you're kind of like breathing in the energy that is transmitted during the matches that take place there, and the pyro and the vitriol between the fans. Like, if you went there and you didn't see a match against River Plate, like, it might be a little bit of a wasted trip down there. But I actually had them number one on my list. And that we've actually,
we've
checked off all the stadiums on my list. So I don't know if there's anyone else left on yours, given that you didn't really have an
order.
That was all of them. So we did get some listener replies in, and I think there were some pretty interesting ones out there. And a lot of people, this won't surprise you, they lean towards the more historical ones, but also the clubs they support. So Mike Ackley, he said no surprise, but the Emirates. He also listed off ones that we listed, Azteca, Celtic Park, Providence Park, at Stadium of Light, thanks to the Sunderland documentary. Colon Stadium, La Bombonera, the Rose Bowl, I thought was an interesting pick, one that's got a lot of history here in the U.S. Thanks, Mike, for that one. Browntown on Twitter, he's a big Liverpool fan. He says Anfield, not surprising there, the Maracanã, and then the Estadio Municipal de Braga, one that I threw out there. Rupesh Sharma, he threw out Anfield. He's also a Liverpool fan. Signal in Duna Park, that's over in India. Estadio Olimpico in Rome, Camp Nou, which I'm surprised didn't make it onto either one of our lists. Estadio BBVA in Monterrey, San Siro, Wanda Metropolitano, and then Providence Park too. So, you know, again, people kind of just lean into the clubs they like, but there are just so many big historic stadiums out there that, you know, there really aren't any bad ones to choose from. As far as that goes on. So thanks everyone that threw those out there. The weirdest one that I saw out there, but one that came from a listener in Pittsburgh, Angry Rooney, he threw out Highmark Stadium, home of the River Hounds. He would give his left nut to be with Steel Army supporters right now. And I feel a lot of us would love to be at the home stadiums that we're used to going to. We'd probably throw those into our bucket list right now too.
Yep.
That brings us to the end of this week's show, clocking in at just under an hour this week. So you're welcome once again. Yeah. We're running out of topics. So if you have some top tens you want to throw our direction, we will hear you out and see what you guys want to talk about out there. And give us
top 10 gingers.
Jeremy.
Steve Sidwell, Alexi Lawless. And
John Arnorisa.
There you go.
There we go. We just did next week.
Loretta went to the redhead, right? Is he? There we go. We'll count him.
Rope him in. As always, if you have anything you want to talk to Jeremy and I about, you can get us on Twitter. Jeremy's at Jeremy Lance. I'm at Wrong Side of Pond. And stay safe out there. Continue washing your hands.
Remain indoors.
Yeah. So that we can go outdoors soon. See ya.
See ya. And there will come a time when we're slowing down. And we'll hold on to memories. Till then, let's wreck shit and hold it down. Love when you're telling me. One day, we'll think of these moments. Cause I, just like this, ain't this the little things.